This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Anthropocene is considered to be the time period when human activity is the dominant influence on climate and environment. I mean, think about the Ice Age, right? Ice Age, what was it that changed everything and dictated where people were going to live and what kind of stuff was going to grow? It's ice. Now it's us, and we are the Anthropocene, and we may well be living in that period now. At Duke University, two professors, a legal scholar and a theologian, have teamed up to ask the big thinkers of the world to go back to the basics and reevaluate core teachings in their fields, given the fact that humans play such an important part in the future of the world. They argue that if humans are now the main force shaping life on Earth, maybe we should reframe our legal structure, our schools, our government, and even the way we think about religion. The multidisciplinary project is called Rethinking Humanity's Place in an Anthropocene World, and it features classes, seminars, and public conversations hosted by the Kenan Institute for Ethics at Duke University. Norman Wirtzba is one half of this duo. He's a professor of theology and ecology at Duke University, also a senior fellow at the Kenan Institute for Ethics. Norman, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Great. Good to be here.
Also with us, Duke Law Professor Jedediah Purdy, the other half of that team. Welcome back, Jed.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be with you.
All right. So tell us about this era epic that we're living in, the Anthropocene.
Well, as you said, it's the time when people have become the main force driving the future of the planet. You can think about it concretely in a few ways. We all know that the chemistry of the atmosphere is being transformed dramatically. The share of carbon in the air is approaching twice what it was in the pre-industrial period. And that's having enormous disruptive effects on every kind of Earth system. You can also think about it more concretely. We've remade the surface of the Earth so completely that if you're a person who weighs 150 pounds, there is out there about 27 tons of human-made infrastructure supporting your life. Roads, houses, soil that's being constantly farmed. So we're dragging an enormous transformation of the world with us everywhere we go. Our lives are a world-making activity.
And we have no competitors anymore. We used to have to compete to eat, and now, more or less, we can get along without that.
Our domestic animals outweigh wild mammals by about 20 to 1 right now. There's nothing out there but us. And our things.
All right. So what does that mean, Norman, in terms of what the responsibility? Obviously, we've been doing all this without giving it a name. We've been doing it for the last, whatever you want to call it, 500 years when we've really taken this dominance and haven't given us much thought. Now the impact is clear. What do we do?
Yeah, I think what's called for is a fundamental rethinking about what it means to be a human being and what it means to live a good human life. So, for instance, if you go back a few centuries, people used to describe the goodness of a human life in terms of the contemplation of nature, which meant that you're supposed to bring your life into a kind of alignment with the powers of nature all around you, because in that harmony, flourishing happens. Well, that notion no longer obtains, because we're now living in a world where there is no real nature, because the divide between artificiality and nature has been completely broken. And we're also recognizing that we couldn't come into harmony with nature because we dictate the terms by which nature moves. Now, that's not to say that there aren't natural processes still going on and that sometimes those processes might not overwhelm us, like the hurricane we're seeing develop down in the Gulf. But we also now realize that any of those kinds of what we call natural events, or previously called natural events, have the mark of the human economy on it. And so we have to figure out, what does it mean to live in harmony with something that is no longer outside of us, separate from us, but is in fact dictated by us? That means we have to think about what is good now in a new way.
See, according to the Judeo-Christian tradition, the thinking about what is good and what is not, eating from the tree of good and evil,
right,
was the original sin. It was precisely that kind of separation from nature and deciding what's good and what's not that got us into this mess in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, that's a passage that's got a lot that we could talk about. But I think one thing the passage is alerting us to is human presumption. Right? The desire to exceed what are proper creaturely limits, right? The desire to assume the status of a kind of godlike being, separate from the world, able to have the world on his or her own terms. And I think the Anthropocene is that time now where we're seeing how economies, political institutions, social institutions that are now designed to give us the world on demand at a cheap price, right? With the click of a mouse, maybe has gotten us into some trouble.
What's a mouse?
Which one are you talking about?
Right.
Jed, let me ask you about that. Isn't there a paradox in that? What the inherent paradox is, okay, we got here because we made this presumption that we could distinguish between good, and we're going to make more good because we like the good, and we're going to. But then again, who's in power, right? It determines what's good. And if you're on the other side of the power equation, what's good for you may not be good for them. So that's the first problem. And now here we are having to do, as Norm says, decide what's best for us so we can get out of this. Aren't we the ones who are precisely not the ones to make that choice?
Yeah, and we're also the only ones to make that choice. That is, no one is going to make it for us. The fact that whether or not you think we're alone in the universe, which I am in some ways, I think, more inclined to believe than Norman is, because he is a Christian and I am not, no one else is going to shape the planet. We're already doing it, but we don't have institutions or vocabularies to do it intentionally and in a way that can maybe make us responsible to one another and even somewhat responsible to the other creatures who are here with us, in respect to which we're definitely not alone. So we desperately need institutions that can make this activity more intentional and more responsible, exactly because it's already happening.
So before I get you to solve the problems of the world, talk about your project and how you would hope that that would lead or contribute in some way to an answer. I'll stay with you, Jed, then I'll ask you, Norm. What's the project and what do you hope to accomplish by bringing people together to think about these things?
So we start with the assumption that the university is and should be a really important place in the bigger ecology of social life, and that the work people are doing in their different disciplines and traditions is valuable even in a time of emergency, but that it needs rethinking in a time of ecological emergency, because all of the methods and all of the central questions of disciplines, from law to political theory to economics to theology, were shaped in a pre-Anthropocene time. In some deep way, they assume that the world is just there and is going to keep being there, and that we don't have to put the question of what we are making of it front and center. So what we're inviting people to do is ask, from their various disciplinary perspectives, how would you reshape the work of legal scholarship or the work of history or the work of economics or anthropology if you took a huge step back, thought about everything at once, and realized that the questions need to be reformulated in Anthropocene terms?
Yeah, I think this is a really exciting and necessary time for us to be asking these big questions again, because life in a university is such that it's very easy to stay within your disciplinary specialization. And in that kind of a context, you don't step back to see how other people have thought about large questions. And so bringing people into a room, and we're envisioning doing this in two ways, one with senior scholars from around the world who will come to Duke for a three-year period to talk about this together, but also graduate students who are at their very early stages developing into scholars, to have them in conversation with people who think very differently than they do. And, you know, part of the job that we have is, when you want to open up a space for big questions, you need people often from the margins who are asking or framing things in ways that disciplines are not used to having to entertain. And so we hope to bring in some folks. We're bringing in Bill McKibben as our first sort of loose lecturer who'll be here in later September. But these are going to be the kinds of folks, along with many others, who are going to present to us certainly the problem situation we are in now, but hopefully also be proposing ways to think radically in new ways.
What about, let's talk about that in terms of theology. For instance, ideas of God and a supreme being evolve at a time when humans are very much subject to the whims of nature. They are subservient, right? Subordinate creatures.
Right.
We're not anymore. Right. There may well be a deity, but we don't feel that we make stuff and we can outthink most of what's around us. So where does theology, a theology that evolved in a very different time, even fit into that picture?
Yeah, that's a great question, Frank. And I think one way to start is to ask whether or not it's possible to speak of something called the sacred any longer. Do we need to find ways to rehabilitate that language, that grammar, that way of sensing the world? Because whether or not people will admit it. I think for the last several hundred years, though there are plenty of churches, we live in economies, political forms that are practically atheist. So it's not as though God has played any major role in the way we build our environment, structure our economic life, these sorts of things. So again, the questions for theology are immense because I think too many theologians or people of faith assume a world that no longer obtains. And so we got the dual task of helping these folks see that we are in a very new situation, but then also to help them see that the theological sources they've often used have not done them a good service.
How about the law, Jed? We have a legal framework over that has evolved over the past 500 years that's very specific to a time and a place, and it makes some assumptions about human beings as rational actors, as supremely independent. Right? There's no aristocracy that can tell us what to do. We're autonomous beings who collectively do this, and that we're rational, and that our choice can be trusted, right? Because it's based on rational means. Now, as we're seeing what algorithms can do and how they can throw us around like rag dolls, and how Google can shape our opinions by sending out articles to various folks based on their algorithms, a lot of that's in question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think the law has made two deep assumptions that don't hold anymore. It's assumed that there's a world out there for us to draw on and manage that we're not fundamentally remaking or in danger of destroying. And it's assumed that the only ones that we are responsible to for the way we use it ultimately are one another and maybe at the most future generations. I would say going forward, everything is environmental law. The law of agriculture and food is environmental law. The law of energy is environmental law. Global trade is environmental law. And it can't just be about us. We have to think about ways to build institutions of decision-making that can somehow make us better at hearing and seeing and responding to and imagining the experience of things that are not human but are here with us and have their own perspectives and their own interests and ways of being. Because if we can't imagine them, then we're going to destroy them by default.
I want to just follow up on, you put your finger on something really important, Frank, when you asked about the question of reason. How rational is it for human beings to design systems that end up undermining the possibility for their furthering life, right? So the question of reason is a very, very important one, right? We've seen forms of instrumental reason develop. And I think other cultures, indigenous folks, for instance, would look at that structure of reasoning and say, that's not rational at all. Right. Right. So even if you think about the original sort of definition of philosophy as a kind of love, where's love in any of the rationality that we have if the work that we do through reason brings about the end of our own life and the life of many, many other beings?
Well, you know, engineers are famous for saying that every system is perfectly designed to deliver the results you're getting. And so if you lived in a world in which technology was no part and you've been doing that for millennia, it's quite successful, whatever reason, whatever rationale brought you to those systems and institutions.
Oh, yeah.
They work. And so then for you to slap the name on reason after the fact and say, well, this particular system of finance, capital, and globalization is working for us, you might ask, working for whom? But again,
right.
The point is that you can't denigrate another system of thought and another system of consciousness, right, just because it is unfamiliar to you.
Well, let's take this in one direction, artificial intelligence, right, which is developing rational systems that are of tremendous sophistication, powers of computation that greatly exceed anything we can imagine. And what's puzzling is to see now the folks who have been at the forefront of this, some of them boosters, some of them critics, who are saying that we're in the process now of developing intelligences which are so vastly superior to what we can now do and understand that we're really talking about the extinction of human reason, right, and the extinction of human life. How do we talk about that right kind of possibility, which is supremely rational, even extra rational? I don't know that we've got very good tools for doing that, but it relates to some of the concerns that we have in this project about what are the fundamental modes and the fundamental assumptions we have when we do any of our deliberative work, and then also how that applies to the kind of action that we perform in the world.
Well, along those lines, I mean, what Norm is saying, that we have always associated consciousness with reason, mm-hmm. right? We've always assumed mm-hmm. that one goes hand in hand with the other. What artificial intelligence proves is that you don't need consciousness to be reasonable, and in fact, computers outdo us. There's a computer on a board of a pharmaceutical company whose decisions on investment have been far better than any other board member. I mean, you know, Moneyball back in the 90s proved what computers can do, and that wasn't even AI. We've got algorithmic trading on Wall Street that can trade billions up and down in a heartbeat on an errant tweet, and fix it before the humans have any idea what's going on. Which is to say, I guess, where is consciousness? Consciousness is actually our problem. It slows us down, right? Yes. So where's the place for humans in the world of AI? I've really launched us in a whole different
I think in the end there isn't much place right? for human beings yeah. because we're inefficient.
Yeah, at this kind of a thing.
Sure.
I mean, if you think about all that you're doing now with your Fitbit and everything else, suppose your Fitbit would just feed you. You would absolutely cede your free will to eat what you wanted if your Fitbit said you need, you know, a little more B2 and a little less
thiamine. I'd ditch the Fitbit,
I think. No, you would, because you were raised, you know, a gourmand. But two generations down the line, when your GPS not only tells you where you're going, but will drive your car onto the better route because there's a traffic jam up ahead, you will cede all of your free will to that GPS.
So this is exactly the point, I think, that, as you say, we've built a system that is so good at delivering the things we've been trying to accomplish that it makes us redundant, as well as making redundant or eliminating as a side effect much of what we share the world with. So we need means to step back and ask, what were we trying to accomplish in the first place? My own view is that what people can do that nothing else can do is to have relationships, to contemplate, to love, to fear, to desire, to appreciate, to turn back on the world and admire it and try to articulate why we admire it. If you think about what we would be doing at the end of time if everything else were solved, I think that's what we would be doing. So if we've built a system that's going to pell-mell make it impossible for those activities to happen or be valued, then we need to take three steps back and ask which direction we want to take this thing.
I think at root the question is, who is the human being that's at work in the Anthropocene? And who do we want to be as people, right? That's a fundamental choice. I don't think many other species of beings need to worry about who they are. You know, that's a question that was opened up by philosophers a long, long time ago. And I think we've lost that question in all sorts of ways, because whether we're beset with the desire for comfort or convenience or immortality even, the question of the human ends up disappearing altogether, because the technologies we've developed end up making us either redundant or simply a bother, so we move past humanity.
Apparently, you two don't think it's too late.
I have children, so I can't think it's too late. There's a lot of work to do, for sure.
I take it as an axiom that history actually is surprising, and that we don't have intellectual license for despair, and that even if we were 99% sure it was too late, this would still be the best thing to do, rather than just feeding the algorithms. Yeah. I wouldn't say that I am altogether optimistic, but I think we have to have solidarity with the other people who are in this situation with us and try to work creatively in it.
Yeah, and I would just say, too, that to give in to complete despair is to presume to know the outcome. And I agree with Jed that we don't know the outcome. I want to leave room for surprise, maybe even serendipity. And so in the meantime, if we have love at all within us, we've got a lot of work to do.
I want to thank you both very, very much for being on this program. Norman Wirtzba is a professor of theology and ecology at Duke University, senior fellow at the Kenan Institute for Ethics. And Jedediah Purdy is a professor of law at Duke University. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks for having us, Frank.
Their new interdisciplinary project, Rethinking Humanity's Place in the Anthropocene World, features classes, seminars, and public conversations. And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Africa Unplugged. Stay tuned.